welcome back to Camera Creations, another podcast. It's show 11, and I'm joined today by Chris Clayton, Ian Bundy, Charlie Winston, and special guest Ed House. Hello, everyone.
Good evening.
Hello. Hi. Hello.
Yes, that's right. Say hello. When I say hello to you, you say hello to me. It's a civil thing to do. Welcome to you all. Ed's come on specifically, hopefully, to talk to us about macro, our theme of the show. And it is Wednesday the 19th of November at the moment. So, yes, we should get straight into that, I suppose. Macro is a thing that I used to do back in the day when I had a film camera. I had a Tamron 90mm f2.5, which I loved playing about with. I even got a extension tube for it at one point and made it even more macro. We're about to have a discussion, no doubt, about what macro means. I did check that before we started, and Gemma tells me the strict definition requires a magnification ratio of 1:1 or greater, meaning the subject size on the main camera's sensor or film is the same as its real life size. This technique can also be done with close-up filters and extension tubes, and that's what I did. And that lens back in the day was really, really good at that, and it was famous for being a macro lens. Since those days, though, I haven't touched it really. I did have a go this week with the lens I have got, which has got a 1:2 macro facility, which I think is very common these days. But yes, Ed, take it away. Tell us all about macro and what you do and how you do it, and let us chip in and the gang can ask questions of you.
Oh, thanks, Ed. So I think just to start off on sort of why it sort of bit me, I suppose, is it's as you say, you're magnifying stuff much larger than you would be able to see it with a naked eye, so it's a real window into another world. You can't often see the details that you're able to look at through the camera, so it's every mundane thing you look at can hide some things that you just don't see. I'm not quite at this level yet myself. Most of what I tend to sort of take pictures of is, you know, bugs and flowers and whatever. I'm still very much getting experience in it, despite having taken many thousands of them. I'm not sort of a naturally artistic person, but there are some people who manage to turn it not just into sort of a study of small things, but also something very artistic as well. So that's sort of what I'm aspiring towards as I get better at it. But I think it's quite, and it can be quite, like you say, there's a strict and true definition of 1:1 magnification, but even that then gets a bit with equivalents of sensor sizes and things like that then gets a little bit woolly. So I tend to like to think of it as close up and macro. If it's something, from my point of view, if you're seeing something bigger than it looks, that's when I start to get interested with it.
Okay, that brings us to very swiftly to one of the questions that Chris was asking before we recorded, which was exactly what you were just talking about. Chris, your question.
You're gonna have to remind me, Ted.
what he said was, if you have a different sensor size, if you've got 1:1 on a full frame, then yes, if you've got a different sensor size, why not just crop it or zoom it? Isn't that going to be just the same?
It is, to a degree, yeah. So if you've got a, if you take, I'll give you an example of something I've been looking at on Wex quite a lot lately and trying not to purchase. the Pentax 100mm macro lens, right? That's 1:1 on full frame. And
right,
we'll probably get letters now. I'm probably gonna fluff this up. But if you then put that on an APS-C camera, that then is, I suppose the appropriate ratio would be to do it in full numbers, but it's 1.5:1 because you've got that 1.5 crop factor from the sensor. You're actually in equivalent terms, it's the equivalent of a full-frame sensor with a 1.5 macro. It's much like all the other equivalent things. It's so the 1:1 macro on Micro Four Thirds is actually really 2:1.
You mean because it's one
you're
to
cheating.
Two.
Well,
so
I can't remember which way round the ratio.
One to
frame terms.
1:2 is half life size. So on,
it would be 2:1 then, wouldn't it?
So it would be 2:1. Yeah, I did have it right because you're upping the magnification. What you're doing while you've got a 120mm 1:1 lens, and you put it and it's on full frame, and then you adapt it to Micro Four Thirds. That then becomes a 240mm equivalent. So by shrinking the field of view, you're enhancing that magnification on that point. It's not really, because obviously you've then got, you know, megapixel size and sensor performance and all the rest of it. It's not as simple as that. You know, you're not by adapting a full frame lens to a Micro Four Thirds, you're not just going to suddenly get, you know, twice as good and clear macro things. There's obviously, you know, lens performance and all that sort of stuff in there, but it is sort of affected by equivalence. And you can see actually the 35mm lens that Nikon released recently for their APS-C lenses. So this 35 1.7 DX macro lens they've released, they're quoting it as effectively a full macro lens because it gets 1:1 on an APS-C sensor. It gets an equivalent to a 50mm equivalent magnification to a 50mm lens at 1:1.
The actual optics
don't get you all the way there. It's the crop factor that then does the rest of the work.
Which is exactly what Chris was saying. So if you're not going to take into account sensor specifications and megapixels and megapixel sizes, then I suppose it's true to say that true macro 1:1 is with film gone, it doesn't really count because with huge variations on sensors, it could mean anything, couldn't it?
Yes, yeah, basically. And I suppose if the definition went to a you know, okay, we're going to do it as an equivalent magnification, then that would, I suppose you could then set that as the standard. It's meaningless, and it's totally not meaningless because you still need something to frame it with. Sure. At the end of the day, we need something to compare it to.
Okay.
So I suppose it's like sensor sizes. Then, you know, a tiny little compact sensor, yes, it doesn't give you the performance a full frame does, but they're actually still quite good and they can still give you very good results. But in the sort of digital age, you've got that scale. You know, if it's a smaller, if it's a one type, you know, type 1 over 2.3 inch sensor, then you know it's not going to give you as good a performance as a 35mm sized sensor. So I suppose it's that same thing. It's knowing that it's smaller and knowing what that scale is, but I suppose it's maybe a little bit more important to pay attention to what your lens really has. Nikon example is very, it's a very, very good illustration of it, because that lens, it'll be the same roughly as a 50mm lens on full frame, giving you that full 1:1.
Okay.
So it gives you a scale of it, which is
so tell us what gear you use in order to practice your macro art.
So at the moment I've actually just recently got an OM Systems EM10-4. What is it? Olympus. Still says Olympus on the camera, and I still use the older EM1 and the Panasonic GX7, and I've got the Olympus 30mm 3.5 macro and the 60mm 2.8 macro.
That 30mm is the one that keeps going on sale, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, it is. And it's if you want to try macro on a shoestring, that's what I'd recommend. You do have to get pretty close to it. I put a couple of examples in the group album. So it's a close up of the very center of a. I'm not a very good gardener, so I'm not going to say what the flower is and embarrass myself. But it's the very center. You can see the sort of the star shape. Yellow in the middle with the bits in the middle of the flower, and then the sort of the accompanying picture being the shot of the camera where it was when I took that picture. You can see how close you have to get. That lens actually gives you slightly more than 1:1 macro. Which I suppose, again, with the equivalence, technically it's about 2.5 times. Which is you know, as you can see, it gets you have to get very close, but it gets you really really high magnification, and for such a cheap lens, it's very sharp, even fairly wide open.
Sometimes so cheap.
Sometimes cheap works. That's fine. But I do tend to, I'll dabble with pretty much anything, as I've sort of said on, I think I kind of said on last time. I had a play with a D610 earlier in the year. I've got a D3100 and I had the Sigma 105 stabilized macro, because my hands are terrible. They shake like anything.
Right.
So I'm not looking at any cameras that don't have IBIS to this, because I tend to shoot entirely handheld and no tripods. No, I haven't got time to sit around taking hours over it. So it's almost all single shot, almost all, just getting it with natural light.
So what's the difference between the 30mm f3.5 and the 62.8 in real terms in practice?
You get much more working distance with the 60mm.
Mm-hmm.
So you're less likely to be casting shadows or scaring off bugs or, making life harder for yourself. The lens itself, I think, is probably just a hair sharper when you get it right, but obviously it's a slightly longer, focal length. So again, with me and my shaky hands, it's probably, there or thereabouts the same. Mm-hmm. If the stabilization in the body can cope with my hands, then the 60 is probably the sharper lens, but it is just it's a slightly it's obviously a narrower crop and a more honed in and a shallower depth of field look.
When I was doing some macro stuff myself, I used to have a bag, like a little bean bag. I don't know if you can still get them, but it was a tiny little bean bag, and you just put the camera on it. It's like a tripod, except that it's really, really flexible. I don't know. Can you still get those?
I think so, yeah. I mean, that's a good idea. I should try it. I think a lot of the pictures I take tend to be... sort of at strange heights, strange angles, because you don't know where you're going to find things. So, but yeah, if you've got something on the floor, then that definitely work.
Mm-hmm.
I do, I should say as well, compact cameras can be just as good at. Again, you're unlikely to get that true 1:1 macro, but a lot of the advanced compacts all had very good. Close up. So, and even the little, Canon Ixus compacts had, they would focus at 1 centimeter. I think, Ahmed in the group often posts some lovely macros that he's got with his. And there's a little shot of a moth perched on my fingertip that I took with an Ixus 180. And it's very sharp and very detailed.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, and you can even just about make out the patterning of the eye on the thing. And obviously you're just on, you know, JPEG only and stuff there, but it shows you can still get some pretty good pictures from compact cameras.
Very good. So what do you gain and lose by moving up to, say, the Sigma 105 f/2.8?
Well, I think the main thing, obviously, you gain the resolution, because that's where Micro Four Thirds is is limited for me anyway. I haven't got any of the bodies that do the fancy multi-shot higher resolution modes, but you gain the resolution, you gain better noise performance, as you do with all photography when you move up to that size. But the difficulty then comes in that because you've got a shallower depth of field due to the larger sensor, it's then much harder to get all of your subject in focus. So I find that after a couple of months playing with it, I could get the photos that could get them nice and sharp with the D610, but because of that, because you're having to go to much narrower apertures to get the depth of field to have, you know, the whole head in focus or something on an insect or the whole centre of the flower, you're losing a lot of that advantage as well. There was a good video on YouTube recently from Scott Keyes, I think his name was. I think I've put a link in the chat. But he did a sort of a comparison, which I think some of the people did comment that maybe you should have left the diffraction correction on. But diffraction is another thing that then impacts the... In theory, it should impact Micro Four Thirds more, but he was finding that the diffraction basically blurs your image a little bit the further you go up through the apertures. So once you start hitting f8, you should be able to see it on Micro Four Thirds, and once you hit sort of f11, f16, you should definitely be seeing it on full frame. But the camera manufacturers have been implementing like a diffraction correction over the years, so you're seeing that less of a disadvantage now. But that D610, I don't think had it. So I was finding that the more I was, the bigger the target, and the bigger the thing I was trying to take pictures of, and the closer I was trying to get to it to get the detail, the more I was having to shut the aperture down, and then as well as the noise and the diffraction, you're also then into longer shutter speeds, and it makes it much harder if you're trying to shoot with natural light. The most proper macro photographers, I'm just an amateur, but you know, most of the proper ones they'll generally shoot with flash nowadays. Like again, that gentleman on the video had a sort of, there's like two flashes either side of the lens in a sort of a rig, so which I personally I don't tend to like using flashes, but that's kind of my choice.
I've got a ring flash somewhere, and it bolts on the front of this little Olympus Tough camera, and it's the resulting images are appalling because it's got such a tiny sensor, but actually it's quite good fun, and the lighting is really, really even. If you can get flash lighting working well, it can be quite good.
Yeah, I did many years ago. I bought a ring flash for my Pentax gear, but I never really used it because I only had a fungus-ridden manual, like, you know, I think it was 1982 or 83, 100mm macro, and it was, I'm kind of hand holding most of the time, and that wasn't really I was struggling to use that, if I'm honest. So
sure.
I ended up moving it on with the flash, but maybe I should try that again. I gather the manufacturers probably have their own solutions for this as well, but they might be a bit rich for my taste. I might need to go eBay hunting.
Okay.
Yeah. So there are, I think. Probably as much as anything, I think APS-C, as much as I'm kind of the Micro Four Thirds champion on here, I might possibly be persuaded that APS-C seems to be becoming a bit more of a sweet spot again, because I think you can look at the Fuji 40 megapixel sensors, and that's quite high pixel density, and so you probably get quite a lot of detail out of a target with that. So I think that's teasing me at the moment.
Okay. Right, so you start to talk here about the coverage in the photo press, and you've got an example of someone taking an amazing shot.
Yes, yeah, so there seemed to be, I sort of noticed it's a bit of a trend lately, and maybe it's because, again, the algorithms are working out what I like and just serving it up to me, but I've noticed there's been a lot of articles across different publications for, you know, how to get good macros and how to and sort of lots of competitions focusing on close-up and macro photography. My personal theory on that being that's probably the thing that that's probably the thing that the smartphones can't really challenge at the moment. And like we've said, I think we said before we started, if they start implementing things like multi-shot stacking of focus as well as noise and dynamic range and stuff, then at that point they might start challenging, because at the moment you can't control the aperture on any of the telephoto cameras, and thereby again your depth of field is fixed. You can't adjust that in any way.
Yeah,
so that's sort of where they struggle.
I'll just throw in my example from the photograph. Again, in the album, in the shared album, I put in some shots I tried to take with my Nikkor on my D300 body. And there's also a shot that I snuck in there, which was taken with the Sony Xperia 1 Mark VI on telephoto macro mode, and you can see that the Xperia one has got closer and it's filling more of the frame, but actually it's less defined than the one that's taken with the Nikkor lens, and you can see quite clearly there's four pictures in the album that demonstrate that, and obviously the closest one, but if you look at the closest one taken with a phone, the word quartz, it's a clock face, and the word quartz is just fuzzy, and it isn't fuzzy to the naked eye, and so
you can sort of I would maybe imagine that looks a little bit like the digital sharpening has tried just a little bit too hard to sharpen up those edges, because they're quite blocky.
Yeah. But you can get closer, like you're saying, with phones. And I don't really understand what the whole digital stacking thing, to be honest. Presumably that would make that better.
Yeah, it could do. Again, the sort of stacking makes things cleaner from a noise and quality point of view generally anyway. Mm-hmm. As we've seen with phones sort of punching well above their sensor size. But yeah, so that stacking, if you do with any camera, if you take multiple, there's lots of software out there. Affinity does it, which as we sort of talked about previously, that's recently gone free, which is nice.
Yeah.
But so you can put in, I don't know if there's a limit to how much you can put in, you put in multiple, and then it will somehow. Computer wizards manage to get it to take the bits of the image as the focus moves through, which you can obviously then, if you're able to stack, you can afford to use, you know, the sort of sharpness sweet spot of your lens, rather than, so whereas I might have to shoot at, you know, f8 or f11 to get all of an insect's head in. If you can stack it, you could shoot at f4 and then let the software cope with the shallow depth of field and give you a sharp shot at the end of it.
Okay, let's bring in Chris or Ian here, I think, and possibly Charlie, to talk about post-processing on this and that stacking thing. Have either of you used that?
Focus stacking, not for macro, because you need... you can do it in camera. The Sony cameras has... focus stacking there, but it's not something I would be able to quickly get up and running, faced with an insect that I wanted to take a picture of. But if you've got a static subject, then yeah, I've done it for landscapes. You just sort of take a focus in sort of three or four gaps and then in Photoshop. You just select them all and it will put them into one picture for you. But yeah, obviously macro is kind of a big deal on full frame, because I mean, I have put a few pictures in there. My favorite one's the bugs kind of hitting each other. If you look at the metadata in that image, you'll see that's f4 at 200 millimeters, but you can see that the back half of this sort of cockroach and the other bug totally out of focus. So.
That image has got me thinking I want something bigger.
Yeah,
despite being the four-thirds ambassador, if you like. It's really, really good.
I'm just reminding myself of this image. I took it earlier in the year. 200 millimeters, yes. So I was at f4, but that's probably because the ISO is at 6400, because the shutter speed, I'm obviously prioritizing getting a sharp image at 1,000th of a second. But I can look at the megapixels, the 28 megapixels. So this is like 100% crop. So so you've got 6400 ISO and 100% crop, and it's still giving you a lot of detail. So I'm surprised how well that's come out, to be honest.
Where did you take that, Chris?
That was in Thailand. We were just
It wasn't a zoo or anything like that. It was something on the
street. It's just we were just sitting in a hotel having a coffee outside. And I just saw this little blue bug on its own, and then I saw the cockroach, and then a few minutes later they had this war that went on for about half an hour. And during most of it, I was rushing around following them with my Sony camera. Yeah, I should probably say I have the 70 to 200 f4 Mark II Sony, which has the pseudo macro that Ted referenced earlier, the 1:2. So it's not 1:1, but it does a good job. But I guess if you're doing, this is why I asked the question, because 100% crop is basically 1:1. Is that right, Ed?
I would say so, yeah. It certainly seems to.
So the image there would be a 1:1 macro, I guess.
Yeah, I'm considering my position on sensor sizes.
we did sort of mention this photo before we came on, and Ted was asking how I got it, and to be honest, Sony does most of the work for you in the autofocus. You've got an insect autofocus specifically for sort of bugs, and it also has insect eye autofocus. So when I was taking this picture, you get a little box around the eye of the bug.
That's not fair.
Yeah, so I mean, there really is very little user input other than sort of putting the lens in the right place, I suppose. And
but then you've composed it really well, haven't you? So
yeah, I mean,
it's that argument of like how those tools, they, yeah, some people might say that's not fair, that's cheating or whatever, but you've framed that well. You've used not having to worry about it keeping it in focus. You've used that to make it a cracking image.
Yeah, I mean, I did take a lot of you know how it is, you just take sort of picture after picture and then you pick the best ones, so you're getting a pick of the crop. But yeah, it was fun, actually. I did enjoy it, sort of chasing these, and I'm normally really squeamish about bugs, but with a camera in my hand I'm kind of less worried about it, and I'm sort of more engaged, and it was a lot of fun. But it's the depth of field is so challenging.
I noticed with the photos we've been putting in the group, we've both got bugs, we've both got lizards.
Yes.
And and very similar looking lizards. I wish I knew what they were, but also both got sort of hummingbird hawk moth type thing. I don't know what, I guess your one's possibly a more exotic one from Thailand.
Yeah, that was that wasn't the macro lens. Obviously, it's a bit further out, as you can see. That was on the old Tamron 70 to 180 I had. So that was when I first got my camera a couple of years ago. So I've got no idea what that bug is. But the one lesson I learned from that is shutter speed, because I wasn't a quick enough shutter speed, so the wings are just invisible.
I quite like that for those. I mean, I think that's probably like a clear wing moth or something. The one I posted is a hummingbird hawk moth, which is very, you know, basically very similar, but with like a solid wing. So part of that is not your shutter speed. It's the fact that the wings are actually see-through. So you don't need to beat yourself up about that. You would they're only like outlined in black. So But those, you have to take those up to, I think the picture I've got from the, this actually also, this has been, this episode has been bad for me because I've been going back through some of my old pictures and realizing just how much I like the Pentax colors. But like you can see, I've got a picture there from the K70 of what that hummingbird hawk moth with some pink flowers. And that's at f11 and a thousandth of a second, and the wings are still blurred.
So, yeah, I see that, yeah.
You're
only at 50 ISO, though, so that's not bad.
Yeah, I mean, it was very sunny. That was, yeah. You can see from the back of the insect, it's literally in full sun. So I think I was probably underexposing by a couple of stops just to get it all in. But also, again, I sort of expand it out. I don't think personally that it needs to be, well, certainly for me, I don't find that you need to be at that perfect one-to-one for it to be interesting. I think you can find that as long as you can see more than you could see with your eyes. Like that, again, your picture of that glasswing moth, you can see the detail in its eyes. And good luck seeing that while it's flying, because you're not seeing that with your eyes.
Yeah, I think you just kind of, when I took that, I think I was just sort of randomly shooting and hoping for the best, because they sort of move about pretty erratically. But I was just going to say, the picture of the lizard that I took, you can see in the notes, I've showed the original crop, or the uncropped version. I don't know whether that would count as macro. This is where I'm just a bit unsure whether you count that as macro when you're just sort of taking a massive crop out of a high resolution image, but you are still seeing a lot of detail.
Yeah, I suppose close-ups is probably the definition I'd probably go with, just because it's less hemmed into worrying about what's the magnification. It's just, is it an interesting shot? What details can you see? I mean, your picture there, you can, it doesn't matter that you've cropped it heavily, you can see all that detail on the scales. And maybe if I had a higher resolution camera, I might crop more.
Cause yeah, it does give you a lot of options.
You open the depth of field up again there, don't you? Because the closer you go towards your subject, the shallower the depth of field gets again. Yeah. So by cropping, if you can, you are minimizing that a bit. I don't know how it compares in terms of equivalence, whether that, you know, really sort of gets you anything.
Well, that's
obviously
right.
That A7R5 is a really good sensor anyway.
It is good. And well, that lens, that 70-200 lens, is probably the sharpest lens I have. So if any images I'm going to crop, then images from that lens are probably the ones to do it with. Because, I mean, you can see with all those shots, they're all cropped. But you wouldn't really know it.
No, it's it. They're all definitely plenty sharp for you know, getting the image across. I think that's also the thing that so far has kept me from needing to experiment too much with the stacking. I put an example in the notes from a recent sort of winner where I think they stacked like 80 shots to get this close up of a moth's face.
Yeah,
which is, you know, it's an amazing picture.
It's still very shallow depth of field, even with that many
images.
It's crazy. So is that taken with one of those special slidey macro tripod thingies?
I don't know, if I'm honest. I didn't read that far into how they stacked them. That's obviously, I think from a technical point of view, like a sliding rail is probably better. Because you don't then have to worry about things like focus breathing. So the field of view changing as you focus from near to far. That's something I have played around a little bit with on my Olympus EM1, because there is in-camera stacking. That's why I've stuck with the Olympus lenses, is because you can do in-camera stacking on Olympus. But
does it spit out the image at the end? You don't have to stack it yourself after. Oh,
yeah,
right.
You don't have to do it at all, which is not bad for a 13-year-old camera, I think it is now.
So I wonder what, you know, they're really missing a trick, aren't they, the newer cameras with the computational stuff?
I think so, but I don't think the newer Olympus ones are. I think they're pushing that every way they can. They do actually have quite regular like webinars and stuff on how to get the best out of macro gear, which I think as long as you're on the new Olympus new, oh, sorry, I'm saying Olympus OM Systems newsletter, then it doesn't matter what camera you use. They're not going to kick you out for not having Olympus gear.
Yeah.
But they do some very good talks on there.
Is that all to do with them aiming at industry and medicine and stuff, or is it very squarely aimed at hobbyists and pro photographers generally?
I think it's generally, it's been photographers talking to photographers, I think, from what I've seen. It's just been, there's normally some people from Olympus and one or two of their brand ambassadors. You know, like the Canon, like all the manufacturer programs, the people who are sort of doing the best, I suppose, with their gear. So they've done some quite good sort of comparisons of how, you know, how to best use the different lenses, and you know, one of them described the 30mm as a sort of a run and gun macro, so you can easily hand hold it and just sort of do what I do a lot of the time, whereas the 60 is a bit sharper and a bit harder to handhold, and the 90 is more, because it's so, you know, you're on a longer field of view, shallower depth of field, longer focal length, narrower field of view and a narrower depth of field, it's a more tricky thing to use, and I think again you get the best out of that probably with one of their pro bodies for having that in camera stacking with the newer chipsets.
Okay. But, and what part IBIS and OIS play in that?
Yeah, as I said, I can't shoot without IBIS. Yeah. My hands are too shaky.
Yeah.
If you've got good steady hands, then you know, well done. Good luck.
Yeah, yeah.
But I can't do it. I need some IBIS, and that I suppose again, when I look at other bodies, that limits my choice a bit. Obviously, everything Olympus right down the range has IBIS in it, and that's something that is missing from the APS-C stuff at the lower end. Generally, I think Canon has one body, which is the high end. I think it's just the high end. I think it's an R7. I'm going to be wrong now because I haven't researched that. But it's their highest end APS-C body, and Nikon Z50 and ZFC don't have IBIS either. So that limits me in terms of what I would be able to choose and do what so, I want with it, but so, maybe I should try a monopod or something.
So like most phones these days, is OIS in everything?
Most lenses nowadays, I think Chris and Ian and Charlie might be able to correct me, but most lenses seem to be either the high-end ones have stabilisation in them, and often that works with the bodies now. Right. So like Sony stuff but the sort of primes and the lower end stuff don't seem to include it anymore. Mm-hmm. I had that stabilized 105 Sigma for the Nikon D610, but I've looked at the newer version for the Z mount doesn't have stabilization. I don't know if Nikon's own version does now. Their old version did. I would hope they've probably kept
Ian,
it, but
Mr. Nikon. He's gone.
Yeah,
gone. And, he fell asleep.
I've talked him to sleep. There we go.
I'm taking it all in. No, I'm not too sure. I mean, I have had some occasions where using tripods to switch off the IBIS and stuff like that to where it puts some shake into the when I've been doing landscapes. But apart from that, it's about as much as I know on that side.
It does look like their VR, their 105 for Z mount does have VR on it, which should, that'd be good. That's still in the running for me then, if I win the lottery.
Right,
just get myself a job in it.
Any questions, anyone, or anything that you want to still cover, Ed, for us?
I think I've talked enough, haven't I?
Anyone got any questions?
I don't want to put the listeners to sleep.
anyone got any questions about macro? Something that you want to add to kind of go further into, or don't understand still, or thoughts?
Maybe a question for me. Do you use any sort of lighting or anything like that, or is it just purely from the camera?
I'm almost always natural light. I did use the onboard flash a couple of times with the Nikon. I think again, like there's a head-on photo of the of a damselfly in the album that I think that was taken with the flash to bring it out, but even then I was still at ISO 1600 in the day, so wow. It was I think that's probably, I suppose, one other thing to be aware of. The reason I have to get to that point is because most macro lenses lose their because you're cutting off the light that's I think it's partly because you're cutting off the light and partly probably the transmissivity of the optics. As you're getting closer to the target, you're cutting off a lot of the light that's reaching it. So like that Sigma, I think it might have been f2.8, but by the time you're actually at macro distance, I think it was around f4.5. So okay. It would actually, even if you'd set it to 2.8, it would be reading out at f4.5 or f5. I can't remember exactly where it went to. And similar with the, I think, some manufacturers just sort of up the ISO to cope with it, if that makes sense, and you've set the settings you think you're shooting with because that's what you need to get the exposure with that aperture value, but because of those other factors I think they compensate a little bit in camera to give you what you're expecting, rather than you sort of thinking, right, I've got my exposure settings correct, and then ending up with a dark frame and going, why did that happen?
Yep.
But yeah, I don't tend to use lighting. I don't like firing, even bugs. I don't really like firing flashes at things.
Unless they're
dead. I don't like doing it to people. Well, yeah, I suppose that could be, you know. But again, I tend to prefer my subjects living, and preferably not stunned out of their wits.
Fantastic. Okay, thanks ever so much, Ed. That's been an interesting deep dive into macro and some thoughts that will meander around the cranium, no doubt. So do stick around if you've got time, and we'll head off into the panel's catch-up. Charlie, you've been to the capital.
Yes, I went to London on Friday last week. It was very heavy rain. I bought a new lens, the Samyang 14-24 autofocus E-mount for my Sony A7 Mark II. So my plan was, with the rain, to do reflection shots mostly. But I was kind of stymied in my first location because it was the king's, I think it was the king's birthday or something, so they had a salute for him. So my first goal was to take a picture of the walkie-talkie building and have a reflection in the puddle, but there was so much smoke in the air and it was quite cloudy, I just couldn't get a clear picture. So then I went down to where Tower Bridge is, and there's the EY building, and I did a look-up shot there, which you should see in the notes and also in the Camera Creations photo album. So I did a look-up shot there, and you'll notice that that's quite a blue sky. So I did edit it in Photoshop because it was overcast. And you can really see on that photo that was at 14 millimeters. So that was the first photo I took. And then I went down to Canary Wharf, and I tried to replicate the same photo that Chris took.
You're following each other around, aren't you?
Yes, basically. I'm trying to catch up with him because he's got the 9mm lens and I've got a 14mm, so it's obviously a lot. His one's a lot wider, so yeah. It's difficult to get the same the same aspect, really, of the photo. So I did an escalator shot at Canary Wharf. And then I went down to Lime Street, where I think it's Lime Street, where the Lloyds building was. And I had an interesting conversation with a gentleman there. I think he was a banker. I was standing by his Land Rover doing some look-up shots. And I saw this fellow in his car, and he just kind of poked his head out of his sunroof to try and see what I was taking a photo of. And then he said, oh, I do a lot of photography as well. I was like, oh, really? He's like, yeah, I was thinking about just packing it all in, you know, and, working in finance and just taking up drone photography full time. Now, I don't know anything about drone photography, but he did this as a hobby, and he was showing me his pictures. They were quite good. And he taught me a trick, actually. He showed me some of his photos, and I told him I was trying to do reflection shots, which is ironic because I didn't have one single reflection shot. And he said what he did is he would use his iPad or a friend's phone to mirror the image that he wanted to take a photo of to create a reflection. So essentially it was like a fake reflection. You'd think it's like a body of water or something. And he showed me many of his photos, and that's kind of how he was getting away with it. So I think that's something I might experiment with in the future. And then finally, where did I go? I went down to Big Ben to try and get some light trail photos, and I had to change my lens to the 24-70 G Master 2 on the Sony. And I had a bit of a altercation there, because when you're standing on the bridge next to Big Ben, there's a pavement, obviously, then you have the cycle lane, and then there's like this little raised bit with bollards to protect the cyclists, and then there's like double red lines. So I strategically kind of like, they call it camping, I camped on this raised path, really. It's not really a path, with the bollards, with my tripod, and I took several photos of Big Ben. The reason why there's no photos included of Big Ben is because it was messed up by this person. He had a Mercedes, and he was driving down the road, and he turned in the road and drove into oncoming traffic, essentially, and just pulled up right where my tripod was. And then he tried to get out. And remember, you're not meant to park there at all. He opened his door and knocked my tripod over, which I managed to catch. And, you know, we had a bit of a arguing on the street. I told him he shouldn't be there. And, you know, it just kind of ruined the whole experience. And it was raining quite heavy as well. So, you know, after that, I decided to kind of slowly make my way back to the station. So that was my experience of London using the 14-24 Samyang. And it was a good experience. It's very different from, as you know, I shoot street primarily. So it was very different trying to do architecture, trying to copy some of the photos that Chris C does. Mm-hmm. So it was interesting.
Yeah, any thoughts, Chris?
Yeah, well, Charlie seems to attract trouble. Whenever he goes out, he ends up in some kind of altercation with someone.
Chris said I should actually go out with a GoPro.
Entertaining. But yeah, I like the edit on the escalator shot. Teal and orange, it's a classic. I like the look-up shot. And the little tip that the man gave you don't have Instagram, so you wouldn't know this. No. But anyone who has seen Instagram will have seen this quite a few times. A young chap with a camera in his hand will wiggle the camera and say photography hack, and then they'll do what you described, where they'll use their phone as a mirror. So
there you go, I'm out of the loop.
Yeah, it's a fairly common little trick, but it does work well. I have seen that before, but yeah, I really like the edit of the Lloyds building with Horizon 20, I think that's Horizon 22 behind it.
Yeah, the funny thing with that shot, actually, was in order to get it, I had to walk about 3 or 4 feet onto, I'm trespassing now, onto private land. There was a big sign, and it actually said, no pedestrians over this point, private only. And, of course, I couldn't get the shot, so I just kind of, like, walked over. And it's on, like a gangway on, like, a bridge, so I kind of, like, walked over to that to get the shot. Otherwise, I wouldn't have got it. But all the best shots, you always have to go out your way for, really. I wouldn't have got it on the pavement.
That makes it illegal.
Makes it illegal, yeah.
Yeah, troublemaker you are.
Yeah. Lawbreaker, yeah. Watch out.
Okay, Chris, what have you been up to?
So I do try and get out at least every 2 weeks, so I have something to talk about. And I did on Saturday morning, got up for, well, I thought it was sunrise. Sunrise wasn't for about another 3 hours now, so I was fumbling around in the dark for a little while. But I decided to go to Devil's Dyke, which is a viewpoint on the Downs, quite a well-known spot in Sussex, because I saw a bit of fog out the window where I live. So I thought, well, I'm going to get some fog up there. And I drove through the fog and got to Devil's Dyke. It was still pretty dark, but there was no fog anywhere. So I just sort of walked around for a bit. And the fog did sort of roll in, as you'll see in the pictures. And sort of about half hour or so before sunset, sort of the fog started rolling in over the lower lying areas that I was looking down upon from Devil's Dyke. And I took quite a lot of pictures with my 70-200, sort of different sort of areas of the landscape. I had kind of had my pick, really, because you can pick out so many different little spots, little in sort of little moments in the landscape where the fog is and it's changing so quick. It's difficult to know, you know, what to shoot and what not to shoot. I did do a few panoramas, which I posted into the album and in the group here. And these were all handheld, so I was quite pleased that they stitched well together. I'm sort of, I don't know whether I prefer the panoramas or I prefer kind of the isolated sort of compositions within the panoramas. So I've taken a few sort of examples and put both into the group there. Just a quick note on the panoramas that I took. My MacBook ground to a halt over sort of anything more than four photos. It was a real struggle, to be honest. It was painful to edit, like it was lagging. And there was one panorama which I took the whole landscape, 14 photos in total. I have put that into the notes. That took literally about half an hour to spit out the final image, and I couldn't edit it. All I could do was just do an automatic edit, and that was it. Anything else would just crash Lightroom. So it's given me a bit of a crisis of confidence in my MacBook now, and I'm sort of looking at perhaps...
Windows.
Well, definitely won't be Windows.
Windows.
Buy a Microsoft Surface, Chris.
No, there'll be none of that. if it gets upgraded, it'll just be a better
version. Go Linux. Go on the dark side.
My favourite one
no,
of all...
No, don't go Linux. I've been trying that lately for photo editing. Don't go Linux.
My favourite of those, Chris, is the one where the two pylons are sticking up. And I mean, that is just so spooky and haunting. And, you know, forget about the panoramas. That one, I think, is my favourite of the lot. I don't know what other people think.
I really like that.
That's a really good one. You've got several, haven't you? I like the panorama one with the pylons. That's very good.
I like the one that sort of almost looks black and white. I'm not sure if you've done it in black and white, but with the three pylons, it looks like it could be either one of the drawings from the Snowman film from God knows how many years ago, the children's film.
Mm-hmm. The minimal ones, I definitely prefer those, for sure. I was quite happy with that. I kind of got a bit overwhelmed with what I was going to be taking pictures of, so... I do feel like I didn't get the best of the conditions with the camera, but I definitely did get the best with the drone. So just as sunrise broke, I took my little DJI flip up and the fog really started barreling into the hills at that point. I've taken a couple of pictures that I put into the group. One is a free shot panorama, which I did manually in the drone. So I went left to right, took three photos. And the other one, the squarer one, that's a 9-shot panorama. It's three rows of three.
Wow.
I like them both for different reasons. Best photo of the day taken with my little mobile sensor on the drone. So I was really, really happy with that. It does sort of, when you get up on a big screen, you do see the limitations of the sensor, the quality isn't there.
How big's the sensor on your flip?
It's 1/1.4, I think.
Right.
So it's a good smartphone sensor, basically.
Yeah, it's basically, it is a smartphone sensor. But unlike smartphones, they don't give you any computational stuff, so you're kind of stuck.
But then that's good, isn't it? Because the reason we're here is because we don't like that horrible, over-processed look. So
I think there's a good middle ground, because the Pro Raw on the iPhones, I don't like the processing, but it does give you that a lot of latitude in terms of dynamic range. And the drone really does struggle. Anything into the sun, it kind of just falls to pieces. So you'll see that the photos are away from the sun, because I couldn't capture anything into the sun. But yeah, I'm blown away by the first images.
Particularly like that, where you can see there's almost like a puddle of cloud on the top, and it's just running off onto the, with the bright white spot of cloud on the top of the hill.
I did edit that a little bit to sort of make that more apparent.
Emphasize. It's a painting.
Yeah, emphasize.
It's not a picture or a photograph at all.
there is a picture under there somewhere.
Yeah,
So about 10 minutes after that photo was taken, it rolled up over where I was, and it was totally white out conditions. I will say the drone was so loud at sort of 8 o'clock in the morning out in the countryside. I got the drone out sort of a kilometre out at one point, and you could still hear it really clearly, so I was really self-conscious, because people are trying to go for a quiet walk, and there's someone with a drone buzzing around.
Yeah.
So what's your thoughts about upgrading then, Chris?
Well,
you get results of what you've got already.
Yeah, that's the thing. It does encourage me to get the Mini Pro 5 with the 1-inch sensor, but the reason I like the Flip so much, it's kind of, you chuck it in a bag, you chuck it up in the air. I'm really not too concerned, you know, if something were to happen to it. But
can you get quieter rotors for it, or
no,
anything like that?
You can't. No, no, because they're in like little guards. Mm. You can't turn them off. No, I mean, it's just because of the conditions in that day just made it really obvious. Normally, it wouldn't be quite so bad, but I don't really want to spend sort of £1,500 on a drone, because I'd just be so worried about flying it and it sort of getting hit by a seagull or something. So I do like the sort of casual nature of the Flip, but it does struggle a lot with dynamic range. So we'll see. If a good deal comes along, then yes.
Black Friday.
We'll see. We'll see what happens.
Very good. Very nice face, Ross.
No. Thanks, Ted. Yeah. So anyway, that was my trip out to Devil's Dyke for a foggy sunrise.
And Ian, have you been racing carring it?
No, I've been doing very little, to be honest. I've done a few edits. There was there was an event on in Abu Dhabi this weekend. It was the second of this autonomous racing series. So I captured it last year did some stuff for the team that won Munich University. And it was on again this year, which was quite interesting. These Formula Dallara racing cars, all autonomous, so basically racing around the track. The pictures look better than the actual spectacle, but it's improving, I think. But funny thing is that when you're taking motorsport, you always want to get the helmet in focus, and there's no helmet. So I did a few edits for them for that, but that was about it, really. So I haven't been out. Been focusing on, I've got the Oppo X 9 Pro Boohiss camera phone.
Boo.
Which I did mention that it has something about it that my Leica had, that it isn't the best, but it's got something that is pleasurable to use to shoot. So that has been quite good. So my quandary now is coming up to Abu Dhabi is to either go for the Nikon the 50mm 1.4, or to get the Hasselblad photography kit for the phone. But the only thing on that when you put that on, it only shoots in JPEG, not RAW. So I'm not convinced they're going to make an update for that. But that's about me.
Does that have a camera button? No, I shouldn't ask on this podcast, should I?
Yeah.
I'll get told off.
Yeah. Let's move on swiftly. Let's get to the news. Chris, and also, Ed, you've got us an item on the end of the news as well, haven't you? So, Chris?
Yep.
Oh, yes. No rumours. It's a very quiet time of year. I just want to quickly mention on the news the Tamron 25 to 200 Super Zoom that we spoke about before is finally getting some reviews out on it. This is the variable aperture 2.8 to 5.6. £700. I'm obviously comparing it, and most people will, to the recent release Sigma 20 to 200. I'm definitely going for the Sigma. Way sharper, way better image quality, and I will take the loss in light for that extra 5mm for the wide end. I don't know if we've got time to quickly have a quick contribution, but what do the people think about these super zooms? Because when I did have the first gen Tamron 28 to 200, I always just left it at home and thought, what? I don't want to sacrifice, you know, image quality when I've got two lenses that will cover the same distance but a much better image quality. So I feel like that these are kind of just a compromise too far for me, but I don't know what the other guys think.
What about the weight factor? How heavy was the 28 to 200?
They're really light. They're like 600 grams. So
wow.
Yeah,
they're not much different. Although they're quite close between them. I will say that the Sigma has better macro capabilities, I think. I think they demonstrated that on the...
1 to 2, isn't it?
Yeah. So, and it's at 85 mil-ish rather than at the 25 mil, because the Tamron does have some macro, but it's pseudo or pseudo macro, but it's only at 25 mil, I think. So it's you've got to be really close to it again. And that makes it less usable, but
yeah,
it's not much more expensive to get the Sigma either, is it, when you're already looking at £730?
I can
remember when the first 200 sort of 20 to 200, in fact it was 18 to 200 came out back in the day, and everyone was wowing about it and loved it, and everyone had to have one, and they were relatively cheap from the independent lens makers. And then after about a year of everyone wowing, they were all back to their primes again. And I was the same. Mine never left the house. I just much, much preferred my faster prime lenses. So that's my answer to you, Chris.
Yeah, I'm with you, Ted. Yeah, overrated. And
I tend to find that if I'm shooting with a zoom lens, I treat it as two primes. I'm either at full zoom or no zoom.
Right.
It's at the wide end or the end. I never think about the middle, so I might as well just have primes.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, and DJI, a couple of releases this week. Back onto drones, they released the Neo 2. I think Ian's got the Neo 1, but he's never used. Is that right? He's still not used it.
I've used it this year. That's all I'm saying.
Okay. Yeah, so this is the sort of the cheapest offering, mainly for content creators. It's got a very compromised sensor. It's even worse than the Flip that I've got. So the Neo 2 hasn't upgraded that, so that's the biggest problem for me with that. And it's going to cost you £350 with a controller, which puts it pretty much the same price as my DJI Flip. So I would go for that all day long. But if you're a content creator, then I guess the Neo 2 might be a better choice.
Why?
Because it's got this... doesn't need a controller, so you can just sort of control it with your hands by doing various gestures.
Oh, okay.
And it just follows you around.
Yep, yep.
Rather, so it's not for big landscape visitors. It's more for, you know, following you.
Snowboarding.
Riding a mountain bike. Yeah, that kind of thing. Yeah.
Right.
You know that kind of thing. And the second DJI release is the Osmo Action 6. This is like their GoPro kind of range, the Osmo Action. This is interesting because it's got a square 1/1.1-inch sensor. So I guess the idea of this is that you can crop it always. You can take a square image and then you can crop it portrait for Instagram or landscape for YouTube. But the bigger sensor's kind of offset by the fact that you're going to be cropping it. So the sort of resultant image will be the same as a non-square sensor, if that makes sense, with a smaller sensor. Does that make sense?
If you're cropping it, it's going to be the same as before. But if you're uploading it to, say, where it's 1.1:1, like Instagram, it's going to be an upgrade.
I don't think it lets you record the whole sensor, or does it?
It must do, surely, unless you're cropping it.
So just to be clear, this is a little bit smaller than a 1-inch sensor, is that right?
Yeah.
Right, okay. Yeah.
But when you crop it, because you're cutting off either the sides or the top and the bottom, then you're left with an even smaller sensor.
Right, okay.
So, sounds like a marketing gimmick.
It says it supports up to 4K 120 frames per second in 4:3, so you're always cutting off at least a bit.
Yes.
It's not like Panasonic's got some of a lot of their cameras, and I think it's probably getting more popular on the video focused models. There's a lot of talk of open gate recording, so you record the whole thing and then crop it later. Or put it square, I suppose, if you want. Yeah. But does anyone do that?
I don't know. Probably people younger than us.
Probably.
Yeah. But yeah, DJI, they just keep chucking stuff out and they keep leading the market. So good for them, I suppose.
They've got an interesting camera grip for that, haven't they? I don't know if anyone's seen the coverage on that. But it's basically, you know, a shutter button and it plugs into the USB port. And
I've seen it. It's like a modular grip, isn't it?
Yeah, almost makes it into a little compact camera. But But it's sort of again, I'll shout out my usual YouTube channel of going and seeing Micro Four Nerds, because Emily will cover all these small cameras and she's got a video on it. So but it just makes it into a little compact, really. But obviously
doesn't that defeat the purpose of an action camera, because it's no longer an action camera, is it?
Yes, it does, because the grip isn't waterproof either. So you also lose the ruggedness a bit.
Yeah. Defeats the purpose.
Yeah,
I guess if that's all you've got, then might make sense. But.
Yeah, I did see. I went to a gig a couple of weeks ago. I might have mentioned and there was a guy in the front row there who was using what I could only assume was an action camera in like a rig, and that was what he was using to take pictures and videos throughout the gig. For me, I wouldn't want to use something that wide a lens, because I think even you know, if you've got like a, you know, 180 degree or 135 degree, whatever the lens is, even cropped in twice and losing a lot of your resolution, that's still going to be a fairly wide ratio. But you know, if you like ultra wide, I suppose it's fine.
Yeah, if you record the whole stadium.
Yeah.
So the last item is something that you've added in there, Ed, about this sort of AI camera. If you could,
the Kira, Kira, I think they pronounce it. So Camera Intelligence did the Alice camera a few years ago, which was a nice idea. A sort of a Micro Four Thirds body, basically, with no screen and very basic controls that used your phone as the screen and the interface. They've got a very nice interface on it. It's sort of trying to make things fairly accessible. So you've got like dials for a dial for the sort of the look of the picture. If it's probably something you have to see to really understand, but you can sort of, there's a few different looks and you can dial them up and down to see how they affect the picture. So it's very sort of, it's like Photoshop on the go, if that makes sense. And so they've launched this Kira camera, which is basically the same sensor from the GH5S, which is around about a 10 megapixel output from a 4:3 sensor. It's better, I think, in low light and stuff than your typical one, because the I think that sensor is like a dual gain. I don't know if they're doing the same thing as Panasonic do with dual gain and getting better performance at higher ISOs, but the sort of the thing they've been selling it on is this inclusion of Google's, and I can't believe I'm going to say this on a podcast, but Nano Banana, AI. I'm a banana. No, it just feels wrong to say it. I'm sorry, but I guess someone in marketing has had a very good day with that. But it's their sort of advanced image generation and manipulation and all the rest of it. You can control your edits by talking to it and those sorts of things. But those, that nano banana stuff is basically powered by the subscription, which they'll charge you for after the first 6 months. Again, there's another, I'll shout out Micro Four Nerds again, because Emily's done a sort of an intro video on her channel, which again is very, very good. The hardware looks really nice. If you know, I like gadgets as much as I like cameras, and this is a gadget camera, essentially. It's a very nice, you know, aluminium block. It looks really well put together. It uses MagSafe, so, you know, anyone with an iPhone. It does seem they've abandoned Android this time round, so they've said. They haven't mentioned any Android support, which is sad, because the previous generation did. But yeah, she did a good rundown of the hardware, but sort of ended up sort of finishing on a bit of a cautionary note, or a call to think about, you know, where do you draw the line as a photographer? You know, is this still photography? And, you know, what to you constitutes just using AI to generate an image? If you've taken the picture, is that enough, despite whatever you do to it? Or, you know, is it just... do you just do minor edits that you could do in Photoshop? You know, but then you've got masking and all sorts of things, haven't you? So it's quite an interesting topic for debate. I don't know if anyone's got any thoughts on that.
It's the same as any type of art, really, isn't it? AI. I mean, if you're incorporating it with a photo you took, it's just another medium at the end of the day.
My issue is that any edit you do replaces the entire image with an AI generated one. So if you say make the sky brighter, you've got a whole photo that's been totally generated by AI based off an actual photo that you took, but that isn't your photo. And then the sensor, the megapixels, it's all totally irrelevant. It's the output resolution is dependent on the AI model.
Yeah, I noticed that with the subscription. I mean, again, it looks like they've sort of indicated $7 a month, which doesn't seem too high, and it seems actually slightly lower than Google's. But Google's subscriptions have limits on resolution in some cases, and obviously like processing priority, which I guess is, you know, if they're under high, if they're getting a lot of people asking for things, then I guess if you're on the lower tier, you get your stuff less quickly. So. But yeah, the resolution thing. I was curious how that really worked. I haven't played with the web based version of this in Google's system. But yeah, it replaces the whole picture, does it?
Yeah. So any edit that you make, it's the same as Gemini, and Photoshop has Nano Banana built into it now as well. But with Photoshop, you select an area and that area is replaced by AI. But with Gemini, if you put a photo in there and say, you know, change, you know, the wall to this color, the whole image is generated by AI, and there's entropy. So I've seen people do this on YouTube. They'll make repeated edits. So, yeah, change this wall to this color, change the chair to this kind of, you know, things like that. After a while, the person that is in the image changes, and it's not the same person that you took the photo of. It's a different person because it's been repeated so many times by AI-generated images.
Lucky I didn't decide to build a business on novelty portraits then.
No, because
I think if you could just take the picture with the camera and then say now put them in some pink glasses with the lenses in the shape of stars and a nice pink wig, now put them in a scarf with, you know, their favorite football team on, or all this sort of, you know, stuff.
It can do it, but the difference, the old way of doing it in Photoshop, is that the underneath, you know, your fake pink glasses was still the picture that you took, but now that it's not, it's all generated, it's all artificial pixels. And I just, it's like, why even bother at that point?
And I think sort of the I suppose for me, the end result, we're only on a Micro Four Thirds sensor, and as much as I like it for its compatibility and everything else, smartphones are chomping at the heels of Micro Four Thirds in a lot of ways, with the bigger telephoto cameras coming in and stuff like that. So for general photography, I'm not sure I really see the benefit of a dedicated device versus, you know, just having a phone that can do this anyway, and having three lenses. If you've got an ultra wide and a wide and a telephoto on a smartphone, and you can take those pictures, what is that really? What would the Micro Four Thirds lens really get you access to, especially as it's lower resolution in the first place than the smartphone will be? And I know, you know, 10 megapixels on a Micro Four Thirds can be sharper than a smartphone, but also the multi-shot does help in a low light and things like that. So I'm not sure it's
enough.
Really
enough.
Just a question
that IQ
on the
difference.
Let's get back to glass.
The Alice camera. Did it ever get to market? I thought it was a total con, that they've been talking about it for years, and it was a complete mess.
From what I could find out, they did start shipping them in the end. There were lots of manufacturing delays, but they did ship them out in the end, from what I could see on the internet.
Yeah, because I know it's been around for so long. I mean, the concept, and I think we spoke about it on a previous podcast about the Sony thing that you use to bolt to the back of the camera, the big lens thing. But from what I read up about the Alice camera, it was just this Tony Northrop was the only one to talk about it, and there was a lot of feedback that it was just a snake oil thing and never got to market. But
I think, yeah,
now
I think
they just put AI on it and they can relaunch it. So
it does look like it's a very similar device from what. Because Micro Four Thirds, she did have both of them. She did an intro rundown on the first one and has now done the same on the next one. And she just seems to think that the hardware has improved. Essentially, the basic specs remain the same. I think, again, unless you're sort of going to try and use it for Micro Four Thirds over a smartphone or a compact or an advanced compact, you know, the thing you gain access to is, like, you know, telephotos and macros and all the sort of the lenses you can't get in those other places. So I say I'm not sure that it really gains you anything photographically, which is a shame, because it could be fun. But equally, I suppose it's, by the time you're looking at £600-700, I think the list price is set once it goes to sort of normal sale. I think they're saying the list price will be $995, which is, I don't know how much that is in pounds, but it's going to be at least sort of 850, I'd guess. I don't know what the exchange rate is. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of money.
You can get a proper camera for that, so.
Yeah.
Right, okay, enough of that. That's the Cairo. Link in the show notes to that one. Thanks for that, Ed. But just before we go, something that Chris has brought to the Back to Basics section, which I've never heard of. I'm not sure if I'm supposed to have heard of this or what, but I really don't think I have. Chris, tell us about it.
You might have heard of it, Ted, just maybe called something else.
Okay.
It's normally called Zebra Clipping. It just says zebras sometimes in your camera settings. This is where you'll probably, because you'll need a mirrorless camera or a digital EVF. Like a phone will do it as well. So that might be where you've not seen it before, because a DSLR can't have it. But basically, it will overlay, you know, your composition, and it will flash black and white stripes over any areas of that image where the highlights are blown out or the shadows are crushed. So it's like an instant indicator while you're taking a photo that you're going to take a photo where the highlights will be blown out and you won't be able to get them back in the edit. And the same with the shadows.
Okay.
So I use this all the time. I've got this assigned to a quick setting on my camera where I can turn it on and off quickly, because it can be distracting. But it also sort of gives you an immediate kind of prompt to, you know, bring the exposure down so you're not blowing out the image, or If you can't do that without sort of sacrificing the rest of the image, it will say, you know, this is the time to take an HDR photo where you can stack 3 or 4 or 5 exposures and you'll get all that detail back.
Doesn't a histogram do the same thing as a Zephyr?
Histogram, it will do that. It will show you on the histogram, you'll see like that it's clipping, but it won't be as obvious, because if you're looking at a histogram on a tiny little EVF,
yeah,
there might just be one area of the image that would only show up as a small part of the histogram that you won't even see. But if you just quickly turn on Zephyr clipping, I mean, you can't miss it. It will flash at you. So,
and you have this assigned to a separate button.
I have it marked as the down button on my little D-pad thing on the camera to turn it on and off.
That's quite good.
So for that escalator shot that we both took, the skylight is always blown out, which I guess you might have had trouble with in your edit.
I had to mask it and then desaturate it to...
Yeah, and even then, you're not getting back. Like, if you see my one, you can see the buildings through the glass.
Yeah.
Because I've done an HDR stack to keep that detail.
Right.
But the Zephyr clipping will show you that area that's blown out, so you can make adjustments in camera rather than sort of worrying about it in the edit where it might be too late, and it often is. So it's just a quick tip to give Zephyr clipping a go, assign it to an on-off button that you can quickly get to on your camera, and it might save you a lot of trouble and perhaps even a bit of heartache in the edit.
I'm finding references to Zephyr patterning even in Sony's help pages, but not clipping.
That might be it, Ted.
Okay.
Patterning. It's not. Okay. It's just called Zebras. I've just checked on mine. It just says Zebras.
Okay. I've linked just, in the show notes. I've linked to a Sony help page that says Zephyr patterning, and it explains what it is. Exactly what you said. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've just had a look on my Olympus, and on the EM10-4, I can set 2 custom views, and one of the things that I've just ticked on one of my 2 custom sort of displays is highlight and shadow. So that does basically the same thing, but it highlights. Yeah. It shows the highlights in blue, in orange, and the shadows in blue when they clip. So it
strange
does
zebra.
A similar thing. No zebra, yeah. but
no zebra
in orange.
A lot of those.
But it does show you where it's clipping to black.
Obviously the zebras are hippie.
If you're doing a lot of sort of landscape or cityscape stuff, it's kind of invaluable for me, because you're not getting back those details, especially in the highlights. You can underexpose a lot and get the shadows back, but highlights, you're never getting back if they're blown out. So it's good just to have that reassurance that you haven't blown them out, especially with landscapes.
Cool. Okay.
Because, you know, the sky is kind of fundamental to the image.
Thanks very much, Chris. Time is pressing on, so we'll draw a line under the proceedings there. And it looks like GAS might be the theme for the next show, which stands for Gear Acquisition Syndrome. And that is a topic we can probably all talk about for a month. So
I think we're all experts.
Yeah, Charlie's getting on that.
So, come back to us next time for that. Thanks to everyone, especially Ed, for taking the time. You're very welcome to come and join us on the show whenever you're available and have got the time, Ed. It's great to have had you with us. Chris Clayton, Ian Bundy, Charlie Winston, and myself. And we thank you very much for listening if you've got this far. And we'll be back in 2 weeks' time with another round of Camera Creations podcast. So goodbye for now.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.